Again, sorry for being a bit late today, but we were coming to you once again from the Temple for Humanity, Temple of Humanity, I think. And once again, we're on the land of the Burramuttigal people of the Darug Nation, in fact, just next to the Parramatta River. So let us begin with some chanting in homage to the Triple Gem.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Iti piso bhagavā arahaṃ sammāsambuddho vijjācaraṇa-sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhammasarathi sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati svakato bhagavata dhammo sandhitiko akaliko ehi pasiko opanaiko pachatam veditabo vinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho ujjupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho nyaya patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho samichi patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho yadidang chattari purisa yugani attha purisa pungala esa bhagavato savaka sangho ahuneyo pahuneyo dakirneyo anjali karaniyo anutaram punya ketam lokasati.
Okay, very good. Okay, very good. So I feel I should explain to you why I was a bit late today, and like, because when you know, you'll understand. So this today I was doing some work on the Lakana Samyutta, which is the discourses about the monk called Lakana or Mark, right? So Lakana is just Mark. So Mark is well known because he can see the marks on beings that are as a result of their former karma. So he sees all of these different invisible beings, okay? So it's kind of fun chapter because you've got all of these different kind of weird things happening. So one of them is this woman who is a fortune teller. And this fortune teller was unfortunately condemned to a bad state of rebirth because of her bad karma. And like everybody previously who translated this, the Pali word is ikkanika, I translated it as fortune teller. Right? She literally means seer, right? One who, she who sees. And then this afternoon I was thinking, it seems a bit harsh, you know. I mean, she's just there like reading people's horoscopes, you know, telling them what they're, you know, are you going to fall in love? You know, is this going to be a good business? I don't know. It's perhaps not the best thing you can do with your life, but it seems a bit harsh to condemn someone to such a bad rebirth or something like that. I thought maybe our ikkanika is more than she appears on the surface. So this, I spent then the rest of the afternoon trying to find out what the ikkanika was. So it turns out there's a nice story in the Jatakas, Jataka 126, about an ikkanika. So according to this story, the origin story that in the time of the Buddha was that there was a Brahmin who claimed to be able to tell whether a sword was going to be auspicious by smelling it. Okay? Pull the sword out of the scabbard. Give it a good smell and then say whether you're going to be able to smite your enemies with it or not. Okay. So somebody got annoyed with this Brahmin in the court and they decided to play a joke on him and they poured some pepper into the scabbard. So when you're laughing now, okay, when he pulled the sword out and sniffed it, he sneezed and cut his nose off. Aww. Yeah. poor guy. Luckily, the cosmetic arts were advanced enough that they were able to make a fake nose and put it on and no one could tell the difference. Or at least they pretended not to be able to tell the difference. I'm not sure. So this is the background story, okay? Then the Buddha told the story of the past. So the story of the past started out the same. The Brahmin smelling cut his nose off. But that's not the end of the story, because in that court, there was the king had a daughter, the princess, and his brother had a son, right? The prince. And when they were 16 years old, they fell in love, okay? And what can you do with teenagers in love? Sure, they were cousins.
That's what I was thinking.
Fine. So the king's like, what am I going to do with this pair, right? On the one hand, you know, if they got married, then the nephew could inherit the crown and we'd secure the succession that way. And we'd be like, you know, keeping it all in the family, so to speak. On the other hand, I could marry my daughter off to a neighboring kingdom and then secure an alliance like that. So he decided that securing alliances was more important than teenage love. So he decided that he was going to split them up. A story as old as time, okay? A story as old as time. Well, so if any of you have ever met any teenagers, you might be able to tell what's going to come on next, which is that they were like, no, we're not going to take this. We're not going to just do what daddy says. So the son thinks, what can I do? Right? So he thinks, I know what. So he goes and employs an ikkanika, okay, and gives her 1,000 pieces of gold. Seems like a lot, right? Right, yeah, for a teenager. Gives her 1,000 pieces of gold, says, can you help me? I want to marry my true love. She says, no problem, leave it all to me. So she devises this absurdly complicated scheme rather than just, I don't know, sneaking them out of the palace or something like that. No, that's not good enough. So first of all, she goes to the king and she says to the king, Your Highness, I've got some bad news for you. I have discerned with my great powers that there is a kalakanna, okay, literally a black ear, okay, a kind of malevolent spirit or fiend who's hanging over your daughter's head. Okay, but don't worry about it. You don't have to do anything. I know how to get rid of it. I can do the exorcism, get rid of this fiend. Now, just a bit of a sidebar on this story. It is said that where do these ikanikas get their powers from? It's said that they have a familiar, right? They have a yaka, a spirit, who is enslaved to them, and they ring a little bell by their ear, ding, 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 and the spirit comes and whispers to them in their ear and tells them what they need to know. Yeah. So acting under the advice of this supposed yaka, she says to the king, don't worry, I can sort this out. We just have to do like a simple, normal procedure and we can sort everything out. Okay, so first of all, we have to take the princess to the cemetery. We have to put up a bed frame there and she has to lie on that bed frame. Then we have to place a corpse underneath the bed frame. And we have to wash her with 108 buckets of perfumed water to wash the malevolent spirit off her onto the corpse. King says, fair enough, sounds reasonable. Okay, so they go off into the charnel ground. There is indeed a corpse lying there. And they set up a frame, a bed frame over the corpse, lie the princess down. And Ikanika says to the guards, look, there's something that you just have to know about this. This is a very dangerous procedure. Because as soon as the malevolent spirit is washed off the princess, it will go on to the corpse below and your corpse will become alive. You'll know it becomes alive because it'll do something. For example, like sneezing, and then you have to get out. Okay, you just have to run because the fiend, it doesn't want to live in a dead body, it wants to live in a live body. It'll come for the closest live body, so you've got to run as fast as you can. So they're like, okay, so she pours the water over the princess. Now it turns out, well, by no accident, it wasn't really a corpse underneath, it was actually the prince playing dead, lying under the bed, okay? And our sorceress, our Ikanika, gave him a bag of pepper. So that when he felt the water coming on him, he breathed the pepper in, sneezed. All the guards were like, no, the devil's coming for me, and ran away. Then our two young lovers could be together and be happy. So far, that makes sense, right? I mean, so far that's no more crazy than most things teenagers do, okay? So far we're pretty good. Then the news comes to the king. He hears about it. What does the king do? Is the king angry? Does he punish them? Does he force them to split up? Does he do any of those things? No. The king thinks about it and thinks, oh, well. And he says the following verse. He says, you know, that pepper, in one case it was good and another case was bad. So I guess things aren't always good or always bad. And then he let them live together and they all lived happily ever after. So I thought that was very nice. It was very deadpan. It's like this verse which goes, sometimes things are good, sometimes they're bad. You can't always tell, right? It's the most anodyne, innocuous verse you could imagine. And then it's at the end of this completely wild story. So anyway, so that's what I was doing when I came here. And I think you can understand that it was difficult to tear myself away, okay? Anyhow, that's over and done with now. Sorry?
It's still not terribly evil, if that was her past life behavior.
Well, she was, you know, she was, so, okay, so Nilushi's protesting that it still seems harsh. So the idea is that this Ikanika was routinely known as being basically a con artist. So she was like manipulating, deceiving, and it's actually mentioned in a number of texts. Manushmiti mentions it. Kautilya Arthashastra has mentioned it. So she was basically regarded as somebody who was was acting as a so she wasn't just a fortune teller, she was like a deliberately deceitful manipulator using fake black magic in order to harm people. I mean, in that particular one, it ended up okay. But, yeah, you can see that that would be problematic. Of course, Kautilya in his Arthashastra, so Kautilya is the philosopher of statecraft in ancient India, he was like, so what that means is you have to put these ikanikas on the government payroll so that they can then spread the government's version of events around things. So, yeah, so it all gets very complicated. Anyhow. But I thought it was interesting that, well, anyway, she was certainly powerful. I mean, she might not have been kind of morally exactly where you might want people to be, but she certainly had influence anyway. All right, so so after that very silly story to introduce for today, why don't we do some meditation? Okay. So sitting quietly, letting the mind settle into the body. And taking a few minutes to just let your energy settle. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Letting the breath calm you down. Letting it bring peace to your heart. Noticing how the breath becomes so soft that it feels almost silky. Easing your troubles away. Making everything feel all right. Now coming near the end of the meditation. Bring awareness back into the senses, into the sounds around you, into the feelings in your body. And take a minute to reflect back over the meditation that we have just been through, inquiring into cause and effect. Ask yourself what just happened. How did your mind change? What was helpful? What was obstructive? And how does the mind feel like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? So we always reflect like this, review at the end of each meditation, so that we understand how the meditation works. And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. Let's have a bit of a break and come back for some Dhamma talk. Today we continue our exploration of dependent origination. And so far, we began with a general overview of dependent origination. Then we looked at the similarities and differences between dependent origination and various origin myths and legends in different religions. Then we looked at the background and the meaning in detail of the terms we find in dependent origination. Then we looked at the grammar, like how the words are put together. And last week, we started looking at some of the shorter suttas on dependent origination. And we'll spend a couple of weeks looking at a few examples of some of the shorter suttas in the Nidana Samyutta and bringing to bear what we have learned so far. Hopefully, this will give us a avenue to be able to see things more clearly. And last week we also opened it up for a lot more questions. So I do encourage that again this week. So if people do have questions, please do pop them in the chat. Marion's already got us started. Thank you so much for that, Marion. I will get to that, but let me just start with what I was going to do. The first sort of we're going to do indirectly touches upon that a little bit, so perhaps that might be helpful. Also, just a message that Dhiryupa has kindly shared with us that this coming Thursday is Ajahn Chachai's birthday. So thanks so much for letting us know that, Dhiryupa. So, of course, the teacher who I learnt metta from, I don't know how old he is now. He's probably 70, something like that. 70s, maybe. Okay. Fine. So, and I popped into the chat the first sutta for today, and this is the Acalika Kassapa Sutta. Okay, with Kassapa the naked ascetic. Okay, so the most important thing about this particular sutta is that the whole time we're talking about it, the Buddha's having this discussion, and I want you in your mind to very clearly picture the fact that the Buddha's talking to a naked person. Okay, so just bear that in mind, okay? I mean, it can be a bit distracting, right? I mean, if you're talking to a naked person, I don't know. It doesn't come up very often in Sydney. So I'm not sure, but I imagine that it would be kind of distracting. Anyway, the Buddha manages to keep his composure. So here we go. All right, fine. So one time the Buddha was staying near near Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel's feeding ground. Oh, by the way, sorry, just before I go on, just a quick reminder for those folks joining us online. If you can turn your cameras on, then that's appreciated. It's nice to be able to see the people who are there. If you can't turn it on, that's fine. The Buddha is at Rajagaha in Welawana. So these days, if you visit Rajagir, you can go to visit the Welawana, and they've got it's a nice place there. One of the nice things about the Welawana is that it's full of gum trees. So the Indians, for some reason, thought that it was a good idea to plant a bunch of Australian trees there. It's because they don't have enough trees in India or something. I'm not sure. Anyway, feels a bit like home when you go and visit it. The Buddha robed up in the morning, taking his bowl and robe, he entered Rajagaha for alms. And you know, when you go and visit these places, you can sort of see the sort of physical location, and you realize, you know, Rajagaha is like probably 20-minute walk or something like that from where the Velawana was. The naked ascetic Kassapa saw the Buddha coming off in the distance. So who exactly this naked ascetic Kassapa is, we're not entirely sure. There's a few different persons who are called that name in the Pali Canon, but they're all said to get enlightened at the end of the discourse. So obviously either that is just added sort of automatically, or they were different people. I mean, Kassapa is a common name, so could well have been different people. There are still, of course, naked ascetics in India today, and some of the Jains, the Digambara Jains, are naked. And one would imagine that if he was a Jain, that they would mention that. They usually identify Jains as Nigantas. So perhaps he was from a Brahmanical tradition that practiced nakedness, but the text not exactly clear. So he went up to the Buddha, exchanged polite greetings, then he stood to one side and said to the Buddha, I'd like to ask the worthy Gautama a certain point, if you take the time to answer. And the Buddha said, Kassapa, it's the wrong time for questions. We've entered an inhabited area. A second time and a third time, Kassapa spoke to the Buddha, and the Buddha replied. When that was said, the Kassapa said to the Buddha, I don't want to ask much. Ask what you wish, Kassapa. Well, worthy Gautama, is suffering made by yourself? Okay, look, I can't stop interrupting this. I'm sorry. But this is the most realistic piece of dialogue in the entire Pali Canon, okay? That, oh, it's just got a small question. It won't take much time. Is suffering something made by yourself? Usually it's then it's like, I've got a little question. Oh, fine. Yeah, I don't really understand like how consciousness is related to dependent origination. Or something like that. And then you're going like, what is that concept of emptiness all about? And so anyway, so I find that an extremely realistic piece of dialogue right there. So Kassapa, the Buddha's like, okay, you're going to ask, so ask. And he says, is suffering made by yourself? Okay. So they're in the middle of the village. It is a good kind of reminder, though, for, you know, when seeking wisdom, like it's a good thing to be asking questions, but it's also a good thing to know the time and place. So, you know, find the right time and place. If you're not sure if it's the right time and place, then you ask, oh, is this the right time, or when would be a good time? And, you know, people are usually very happy to share what they know, but just make sure that you're not kind of buttonholing somebody in the when they're going for arms round or something like that. Anyway, is suffering made by yourself? Not so, Kassapa. Then is suffering made by another? Not so, Kassapa. Is suffering made by both oneself and another? Not so, Kassapa. Then does suffering arise anomalously, not made by oneself or another? Not so, Kassapa. Well, is there no such thing as suffering? And the Buddha says, it's not that there's no such thing as suffering. Suffering is real. Then the worthy Gautama does not know or see suffering. It's not that I don't know or see suffering. I do know suffering. I do see suffering. Worthy Gautama, when asked these questions, you say, not so. Yet you say there is such a thing as suffering, and you say that you do know suffering and you do see suffering. So let the Blessed One explain suffering to me. Let the Blessed One teach me about suffering. So this is the beginning of the dialogue, which, as you can see, wasn't particularly brief or simple matter. And notice a few things about the dialogue as we go along. First thing is the manner of address. So you can see that Kassapa is referring to the Buddha as Worthy Gautama, Bho Gautama. And so this is a specific term of address used by Brahmins. Usually it's like to Brahmins as equals or as colleagues, right? So it's a respectful term of address for colleagues. And then about halfway through, he's sort of getting all of these answers. He's obviously a bit befuddled. He doesn't quite get what's going on. But then by the end of it, he's gained some faith and he refers to the Buddha as the Blessed One. And so from there, then the Buddha starts with his proper answer. But meanwhile, I want to just unpack some of the implications behind some of these questions. Is it raining outside?
No.
No? Let me just unpack a few of these details for you as we're going along. All right. Okay, so I'm going to be looking at my footnotes for this, and so that'll kind of remind me of all the things that I've done. So you can, that will give you the, but the, I mean, I've been doing a lot of work with this and a lot of work with the footnotes, but of course footnotes are not great in terms of, you know, they're very kind of short and so on. So hopefully I'll be able to flesh them out and give them a bit more meaning through the Dhamma talk. Okay, so the first thing is that this set of questions, is suffering made by oneself, is suffering made by another, is suffering made by both, or is suffering made by neither, or is it anomalously arisen? This is a standard set of questions. We encounter this a number of times in the canon. And it's usually attributed to, you know, different kinds of non-Buddhist groups who are trying to kind of sort this thing out. And clearly there's an important kind of philosophical or theological or emotional issue that hangs on this. And you can see that the whole question of karma, of deeds and responsibility for deeds, is inherent in this. And that first, so I think this is the first thing is just to notice that karma, the idea of karma, was not just something that everyone in ancient India believed in and everyone sort of somehow had that same idea. This is a very kind of sort of reductive way of thinking about it. Actually, it was something that they were very interested in and that they were discussing and differing about in their different interpretations. All right, so first one is suffering made by oneself, all right? Now, let's sort of stop and think about that for a minute and think what is it that this could mean, okay? Obviously, from a Buddhist point of view, there's obviously truth to that from a Buddhist point of view, because we do things and we suffer because of it, and that's kind of the Four Noble Truths. So it's obviously not like completely different from the Buddhist point of view, and yet the Buddha rejects it, which is, of course, what makes it interesting. So presumably then underneath there is some kind of assumption that was kind of understood or is implicit in that discussion, right? Now, we've looked at how these teachings and dependent origination teachings relate to or draw upon or modify various kinds of things we find in the Vedas and Brahmanas. And this is another example of that. So in the Shatapada Brahmana, and if you recall, Shatapada Brahmana is the ritual text on the 100 pathways, which preceded the Buddha by 100 or 200 years, and in which tradition the Buddha studied under his former teachers. Okay, so this is the text and the tradition that the Buddha studied. And so often we find that he's demonstrating quite precise knowledge of things that are found in that particular text. So In that text, it refers to Prajapati, the created deity, as the sun, with the words, you are self-made, swankratam. So it's basically the same phrase as we find here. So this is kind of interesting, right? So if everything is self-made, it's like literally the world is emptied out from the self, yeah? We already saw that the word sankhara, which we find in dependent origination, was used in the context of Prajapati, who created the world from himself, emptied himself out in the world, and then had to be rejuvenated through these sankharas to rejuvenate his energy. So this is the kind of that suffering is made by oneself. I should mention also that elsewhere, here it says it's suffering, but elsewhere it might be like the world is made by oneself, because of course the world is suffering, so they're more or less equivalent. So this is an interesting way of thinking about it, isn't it? Yeah. So it's the idea that when we say the suffering is made by yourself, you tend to think in terms of like, well, you do something stupid and then you get a result from it, right? That's a Buddhist teaching on karma, right? And I'm not saying that that doesn't mean that here. I'm saying that there are theological and metaphysical dimensions to the term that are not necessarily captured by merely a psychological and ethical reading. I think this is one of the problems. One of the reasons why I emphasize this a lot is because in modernist Buddhism, there's always a tendency to read Buddhist teachings in terms of a psychological and ethical teaching, which is fine. Obviously, those dimensions are present. But there's also a metaphysical, there's a religious feeling behind these things. Why did this matter to so many different ascetics and religious seekers, right? There's something profound about what they're asking here. And so this is where that kind of curiosity leads to that. So if we look at it from that perspective, we can see that if the creator deity created this world from himself, each of us is repeating that act. Right? This is how this kind of theology works, especially how the Hindu theology works. We are repeating, re-instantiating what that creator deity was doing. And we are making the world that appears around us through emptying ourselves into the world. Yeah. And there's something quite true about that. Yeah. The world that we live in is the world that appears because we have manifested it. If we manifested ourselves in a different way, then that world would be different, or the world that we experience would be different. So another sense that this can be, okay, so let's leave it at that. So again, I'm not suggesting that this text has to be read in this kind of metaphysical way. I'm saying that there's a metaphysical dimension which captures a philosophical side to this question that is more layered than just an ethical and moral question. So then the next one you say is suffering made by another. Okay, so again, it's easy to think of examples where suffering is made by someone else, right? And, you know, we suffer because of inflation. We suffer because of what the government did. We suffer because our neighbors are playing their music too loud. And we find a number of examples of this in the Vedic literature as well. So in the Rig Veda, you find examples like, let me not suffer for what was done by another, O king. Right? So this is somebody petitioning the king. I'm innocent. Don't let me suffer for what somebody else did. Right? So this is another way that you can suffer from what somebody else does. And in the Atharva Veda especially, you find lots of things like we just mentioned with the Kanika, actually, the kind of the sorcerers, witches, fiends, black magic, spells, all of these kinds of things, all the way through the Atharva Veda. If you want a spell for it, it's probably there. Yeah, they're all kinds of ones. And so we can imagine all different ways in which suffering is created by another. So this, again, seems like one of these things which on the surface of it, okay, suffering's made by another, that's good, we don't have to blame ourselves, but then we have to defend ourselves against the actions of others. And this is the way that a lot of religious life tends to go, actually, that we tend to believe that somebody else is causing that problem, so we have to do some prayer or some spell or something to make that go away. A lot of the time, like I was thinking about this, like actually just doing this research for this Ikanika story, and one of the things that I came across was that they were doing some research on anthropological research on people who were doing this kind of black magic in India. And they're just in a village, and there's this kind of like witch doctor there who's doing these spells, and they talk to him about what he's doing and why he's doing it and so on. And one of the things that really struck me about it was that he was doing it because he was powerless. Like, he was very poor. He didn't really have anything. It was an impoverished village. And when he felt that things were being hard to him and life was unfair, that doing some kind of spell gave him the feeling that he had some power or some destiny over his life. I think it really shifted my perspective on that, because, you know, you think that, like to me, I look at these things, I think that's ridiculous, right, where you're doing this kind of black magic for or something. But I've never been in that situation. I've always been brought up, I've had some feeling that I have some destiny over my life. And so if you don't feel that, you feel that everything is just being done to you, that you're the victim of everything, right? Your suffering is made by another. So you're looking for some way to defend it or some way to protect yourself against those things. So suffering made by another. So suffering made both by oneself and another. Right? I mean, that makes sense, right? Sometimes you do things that cause your own suffering. Sometimes somebody else does it to you, creates their suffering, right? It's getting sounding a bit more reasonable.
No, I'm not leaving.
Sinsin's
coming.
Sinsin's coming.
Oh, there you are.
Sorry, what's the
case? Sinsin! Oh my God.
I was leaving. I was like, enough of this.
I thought so. Look, I understand.
Sorry, thank you.
I thought you heard the bit, suffering's made by another, and then you're like, oh, good, that's excellent. That's sort of that. I now know the answer. All right. So, yeah, welcome, Sinsin. Good to go. You can make it. Okay, so does suffering arise? Suffering arise both by oneself and another. Right? So we can think of examples where that might be the case. A good example might be that if you live under a evil government and the government requires you to do certain things that you don't agree with, then you kind of, well, I was just following orders, and you can do bad things because the police told you or the government told you or something like that. So then you can experience suffering. You're still making bad karma, but it's kind of caused by yourself and by another. It's kind of mixed, right? So it's this kind of thing that it's irreducible. There are many different ways you can construe this, and I don't think that these terms are meant to be. I don't think they're meant to sort of have one specific meaning. I think they are meant to, be wide terms that can encompass a range of different possibilities. If we think, speaking of suffering in general, okay, so suffering is purely one's own fault, right? So the suffering is made by yourself could occur if everything is determined by karma, right? So imagine that. Imagine you live in a world where your karma in your past life literally determines everything that happens to you in this life, right? Yeah? So that would be purely one's own karma is determining everything, right? Your own deeds. Or imagine a world where you were born in a world that individual effort made no difference because suffering was preordained by a malevolent deity.
You call that hell, right?
probably sound pretty much like it, right? Yeah. So, or perhaps just by destiny, perhaps just this, the world is fixed that way, but the idea is made by another, perhaps, you know, basically God made it this way and you have to suffer because that's the will of God, right? So these are like pure systems where it's only by oneself or only by another, right? Normally we understand it's a mix, but there might, you can understand, I'm just saying, you might understand that there are philosophical systems where you think everything is your fault. And I think the idea that like everything is made by your own karma is quite common in Buddhism, even though it's not what the Buddha taught, right? So the Buddha taught that your karma has effects, but he didn't teach that it's the only thing that creates those effects. Okay, so what about karma that occurs by both? So what about a world where some people got to choose their destinies and others were purely subject to the will of fate? Right? Like we tend to think that people are pretty much the same. You know, that everyone's kind of born, we all have our five khandhas, our five aggregates, we can make choices, we live our lives and all of those kinds of things, right? But if you look at, say, on a social level, that it's not really actually like that because some people can choose their destiny to a greater or lesser extent. And a lot of people just can't and they don't really have any choice. Maybe they're enslaved and maybe they are just surviving day by day in poverty and unable to make any choices about how they live. And so that idea of both made by self and other might not apply just to an individual, but it might apply to the world as a whole. Right? So I'm just suggesting some different ways of looking and reflecting about this. It's not something which we can reduce to one form or another. Okay. Any questions about that so far? All right, moving on. The next one, does suffering arise anomalously, not made by oneself or another? Okay, so this word I've translated as anomalously. I actually just retranslated this particular term. Usually it's translated as by chance or fortuitously, which is kind of similar in meaning. But the specific meaning of adhicca means something which has arisen. It's based on the word meaning an exception. Yeah, suffering, that's an exception. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the world operates by chance or that the world is random. It means that suffering arises as an anomaly. Right, it's not everything else might be caused, but my suffering just happens, and there's no particular cause or no particular reason for it. So this is why I've translated as anomalously rather than fortuitously or by chance. It's again similar kind of meaning. And one of the reasons why I changed that translation because there's a couple of places in the Nidana Samyutta where philosophers who do believe in the doctrine of karma nonetheless argue that suffering arises anomalously, right? So it's kind of interesting, right? So clearly it's not a contradiction to the doctrine of karma. It's one kind of doctrine of karma. Okay. So does suffering arise anomalously, not made by oneself or another? So this means that you can't give it a reason. You just like, oh, it happens. Right? That's what we say, right? You know, we usually say we put an SH at the beginning of it, but but it happens, right? And then there's no particular cause for it. Yeah. So again, it's kind of like all of these views feel like there's something to them. Like even though the Buddha is rejecting them, they're not that necessarily completely, you know, from left field. So it sort of raises the question, like, why is the Buddha rejecting them all? Okay, so this is a bit of a survey of what these four are. But suffering is made by oneself, or the world is made by oneself. Again, in the suttas, we find both of those forms. Or suffering is made by another, or suffering is made by both oneself and another, or does is suffering arise anomalously, not made by oneself or another? So, of course, this is an example of the logical format in Buddhism that we call the tetralemma. And this is very characteristic of Buddhist logic and of Indian logic generally, but especially Buddhist logic. And whereas in Western logic, you tend to have the dilemma, two things, it either is or is not, right? And this was established by Aristotle. Something has to be either it is that way or it is not that way. So in Indian philosophy, it either is or it is not, or it both is and is not, okay? Mm-hmm. Or it maybe is not and maybe is not, okay? So this is the four kinds of karma, four kinds of logical alternatives. And it's an interesting way of approaching things because it often reflects the real world more than the binary logic of a dilemma. And the problem with the binary logic of a dilemma is that it conveys the impression that you've created some clear knowledge because you've excluded other options. But all you've really done is hide your ignorance in the terms of your argument. You've already excluded all of those other gray areas and mixes and ambiguities and everything just by the way you phrased your question. And then you reach a nice clear-cut answer, and then you're like, aren't I clever? I've got a nice clear-cut answer. Yeah. So the Buddhist logic encompasses more of those, allows you to, you know, accept more of those gray areas and so on, which, of course, in the field of karma is very relevant. And, you know, I already gave just one example where, let's say you're under an evil regime and then they order you to do something. And, you know, who's responsible, right? Is it the regime that's responsible? Is it you that's responsible? I mean, obviously you'd never defend somebody doing something evil in that circumstance. But at the same time, it's not that they just chose to do that. You know, you can understand that they had to live, they had to make their way in society, they had to feed their family, they had to all of these things, which doesn't justify what they're doing. But it does make it somewhat different than if they just decided to do that themselves. So this is that both black and white karma that leads to a black and white result. And in these tetralemmas, the fourth option is usually, its fourth option is not meant to be something that is mysterious, right? So the neither nor option is not meant to be something that is like mystical or incomprehensible. It's meant to be something that is usually a subtle state that doesn't easily fit into the previous things. So say neutral feeling, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, it's pretty straightforward, actually. It just feels like neutral feeling. It's not meant to be a mystery. So the same thing here, the anomalous things that arise, it's not meant to be necessarily a mysterious category. It just means things that don't fit into the other categories. All right? Okay, so that's the tetralemma. All right, so then Achalaka Kasapa asks, please let the Blessed One teach me about suffering. Remember, they're still standing on the street and he's still naked in the middle of the street. Okay, and the Buddha answers. The Buddha gives the actual teaching now. Suppose that he who does the deed and he who experiences the result are one and the same. Then for one who has existed since the beginning, suffering is made by oneself. In speaking like this, one implies this is eternal. Suppose that he who does the deed is one and he who experiences the result is another. Then for one stricken by feeling, suffering is made by another. In speaking like this, one implies this is annihilated. Avoiding these two extremes, the realized one teaches by the middle way. Ignorance is a requirement for choices. Choice is a requirement for consciousness. And that is how this entire mass of suffering originates. When ignorance fades away and ceases with nothing left over, choices cease. When choices cease, consciousness ceases. That's how this entire mass of suffering ceases. And, of course, the whole of dependent origination is there. Then when this was said, Kasapa said to the Buddha, excellent, sir, excellent, as if he were writing the overturned or revealing the hidden or pointing out the path to the lost or lighting a lamp in the dark so people with clear eyes can see what's there. the Buddha has made the teaching clear in many ways. I go for refuge to the Buddha, to the teaching, and to the mendicant Sangha. So may I receive the going forth, the ordination in the Buddha's presence. And the Buddha says, Kassapa, if someone formally ordained in another sect wishes to take the going forth, the ordination in this teaching and training, they must spend 4 months on probation. When the 4 months have passed, if the mendicants are satisfied, they'll give the going forth, the ordination into monkhood. However, I have recognized individual differences. And Kassapa says, if 4 months probation are required in such a case, I'll spend 4 years on probation. And when 4 years have passed, if the mendicants are satisfied, let them give me the going forth. And then not long afterwards, he was given the going forth, the ordination. He practiced and realized arahantship and realized there is nothing further for this place. So I'm just going to briefly comment on this ordination process. This is a stock passage we find a number of places. I'll come back to the sutra itself in just a second. But first, just a couple of details. First of all, when Kassapa says that he wants the going forth, the pabaja, and the ordination, the upasampada, we translate pabaja as going forth and the upasampada as the ordination. And these days, these are two different things. Pabaja is a novice ordination where you take 10 precepts, and the upasampada is the full ordination where you take on the higher ordination. And that's how the term is used today. That usage evolved during the time that the suttas were compiled. But in the earliest period, and in the period of most of the suttas, pabaja and upasampada were the same thing. Okay, so they're just two terms meaning to get ordained. And essentially you're leaving home and then entering into the sangha. They're basically two sides of the same coin. So over time, then that became split so that you're leaving home was the novice ordination and the entering in was the upasampada. And originally, there wasn't a novice ordination. And even when there was a novice ordination, it was just for kids. It was for teenagers. And it was only later that it became a sort of a separate stage in ordination. So I just mentioned that because it can be a bit confusing if you're only familiar with the modern situation. And the bit where he says he's recognized individual differences. So there are individual exceptions based on persons, but also general exceptions for dreadlocked fire-worshipping ascetics because they believe in karma. So they get an exemption. And if you're the Buddha's relatives, you get an exemption. What? So Ananda, all those were all Nepo babies. I don't know why, to be honest. I have no idea why the Buddha would give a special exemption to his own relatives because they were all troublemakers and they caused such a hassle in the Sangha. I mean, not all of them. Anuruddha and Ananda were pretty good, but there's a whole bunch of them that were like real headaches anyway. I think this stock passage is not 100% clear in terms of the timing. Actually, it says that he said, oh, if you want 4 months, then I'll take 4 years. And then it said he got the ordination. It doesn't really say when. But the feeling I get is that since he showed his commitment in that way, the Buddha relaxed the 4 month period and just gave the ordination right away. That's the feeling I get. But I don't know that the texts are really clear on that point. Anyway, all right. So that's just on that ordination process. Okay, I'm going to go back up to the text itself and look at what the Buddha says, because this statement here is kind of interesting and it draws out the meaning of that phrase in a kind of in a nice way. Suppose that what he who does the deed and he who experiences the result are one and the same. Then, for one who has existed since the beginning, suffering is made by oneself. In speaking like this, one implies this is eternal. All right. So it's not a particularly obvious passage, and I've tried to keep the use of pronouns very specific in this passage. Remember when we talked about the grammar of dependent origination, I talked a little bit about pronouns and about how the Buddha used pronouns in order to create emphasis. So when you say this being, this is. right? You're using the same pronoun this to reinforce that statement. We find the same structure here, that the repetition of the pronoun so karoti, so patisangvedayati, so patisangvedayati. He who does the deed and he who experiences the result are one and the same, right? So that phrasing is a specialized philosophical phrasing that asserts an absolute identity. Right? It's not the normal phrasing in Pali. The normal phrasing would be yo karoti so patisangvedayati. One who does the result, one who does it gets the result. That's the normal way to put it. So using the repetition so karoti so patisangvedayati, it makes it into that they are one and the same. So you're asserting an absolute identity. So again, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to discuss these grammatical details, because they do come up through the suttas on dependent origination, and they do sort of subtly affect how we're going to be reading these different passages. So when you see that that says, if one who does and one who experiences are exactly the same, then you can see, this is what the Buddha's meaning when he says that this is then eternalism, right? It's different from what the Buddha would say, that you do an act and then you receive the result in the future, because that's changing. The Buddha's asserting that the one here and the one there is exactly the same. That's what the Buddha was opposing. And then he uses this phrase, for one who has existed since the beginning, adito sato. Yeah, adito sato, who's been there since the beginning. In other words, you've existed eternally. You've always been like this. When you act, the you who receives this act is exactly the same as the you who exists now. And that's why the Buddha then says this implies this is eternal. This is sasatta. So hopefully that comes through. Right? These kinds of philosophical passages are very tricky to catch. Because you can see that, they rely on a whole kind of bunch of assumptions in how they're communicating, right? They're assuming all of this implicit knowledge, and so often you encounter like this, where we read that sentence and we go, "That's a bit confusing," but then Kassapa hears it and goes, "Oh yeah, that's it," right? It's because they're already familiar with that manner of talking. Right, so that's that one. So then next one, when somebody who does this deed is one and he experiences the result is another. Again, we find this repetition. Anyo karoti, anyo patisangvedayati. Again, this is unusual construction. It means that these are completely different people. Right? So the person who's done the result, done the deed, has been annihilated. And somebody else in the future gets the result of it. So that's why the different person does it and gets a result is implies the annihilationist view, all right? Which is the idea that you exist now, but then you're going to come to an end, rather than the Buddhist view, which is that you're always changing. You don't exist in an eternal form now, and nor will you stop, but rather causes and conditions are constantly changing and manifesting. Okay, so one of the curious details about this is that the Buddha does not, in this particular sutta, address the two final terms of the tetralemma. He doesn't talk about created by oneself and another, nor does he talk about being created anomalously. Okay, interesting. In my footnotes there, I give some references to the Brahmajala Sutta, where these things are discussed in a bit more detail. I won't go into them right now, but maybe I'll just leave that for now. But so that's the SN 12.17 Acelaka Kassapa Sutta, and I'm going to come now to have a look at some of the questions we got in the chat, and hopefully we'll be able to achieve some clarity with these questions, right? Or not? I don't know. Okay, Marion from France. How's France going, Marion? Can't see. Where is she? It's going all right? Up and down? A bit like that. Melanie, also in France. Okay. Okay, so, dear Bande, could you please explain the difference between nibbida, or repulsion, or turning away, and vibhava tanha, the desire for no more existence or desire to end existence? It looks very similar to me. How come one leads to freedom from suffering and the other leads to more rebirth? Okay, so great question. So for that one, what I'm going to need you to do is to, you know about Doctor Who, right? Yeah? You know about Doctor Who? So what you're going to want you to do is to find Doctor Who's TARDIS and get into that and go back to, in time to last Wednesday week, because I actually gave a whole talk on that topic at Crow's Nest on Wednesday week. So if you can do that, that would be great, but those talks are not recorded, so there you have it. Okay, so we can actually approach this question from this particular perspective, helps us to understand this. So we've already talked about the annihilationist view, the idea that this person exists here and then will be ended, right? There comes a point where it's ended. So this is what the vibhava tanha is. Vibhava tanha is I'm existing now and I want to not exist. And so you want to create that situation where we don't exist. And of course, the vibhava tanha is very interesting because it's a very primal and very dark desire that underlies a lot of like self-destructive behavior. Yeah, and when people are like, you know, cutting themselves, or when people are like, you know, getting addicted to alcohol, or all of these kinds of behaviors that are very self-destructive, then we can say these are driven by vibhava tanha, yeah, to undermine or annihilate life, because in some sense we feel like we want to make an end of it. We want to destroy what is here. Now, nibbida is kind of similar in the sense that nibbida is, in a sense, a negative response to things. But nibbida is it's an emotional response, and it comes and goes. Vibhava tanha has more like a primal drive. Yeah, nibbida arises in a certain context where it has a certain meaning in the process of meditation. Yeah, it fulfills a function in the meditation. So it might not just be meditation, but usually we talk about it in the context of meditation. So you're meditating and you feel that you're attached to things, right? And so one of the things that becomes clear in meditation is this pull. Like, we feel this pull to want to stick onto things, and we want to hold on to it, yeah? Stickiness of things. Now, to find freedom at a certain point, there has to be an unsticking, right? You're so stuck to things, you have to actually pull it off, yeah? That's the nibbida. It's the reverse force that detaches you from the thing that you're attached to, which is ultimately, of course, is suffering. Yeah, so rather than being like a primal desire, which is distorting your choices and your behaviors in a way that you're unconscious of, nibbida is highly conscious. And you're aware of it when it happens. You feel it and you experience it. It's not necessarily pleasant at that time, but it has a certain particular function, and it turns you away from those things that are creating suffering for you. So that's how I would describe the difference between vibhava tanha and nibbida. Okay, moving along. Chalin from Singapore. Hey, Chalin, how's Singapore going? All right? Hope it's going good. I was doing a session the other day. I just want to check in with people going around the world. I did this session with my friends from Jakarta last weekend in the Ebasco group, and they were like, "Oh yeah, you know all the things that's happening here." And I'm like, "No, I don't. I haven't seen riots and stuff all over Jakarta." Anyway, hopefully Singapore is peaceful and nice. Anyway, Bhante, would I kindly explain the term fruitful used in the Velama Sutta, AN 9.20? Does it mean the context of merit-making or spiritual path? Be more fruitful to develop a heart of love even just for as long as it takes to pull a cow's udder, than to undertake the training rules. Look, just give me a second to pull that sutta up. What is it? 9.20. Give me 1 second. Okay. 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 So that story is about somebody. It's a story of the past and somebody who gave gifts up to very wealthy and very rich gifts, and then the Buddha's saying that it'd be better to feed one stream enterer, one enlightened person, and even better than that would be to take the precepts, even better than that would be to develop metta, and even better than that would be to develop the perception of impermanence, even so for as long as a finger snap. So this would all be of greater fruit, mahapalatarang. So the Pali phrase that we're looking at here is mahapalatarang. It's literally from fruit, and literally is just a construction meaning of greater fruit. So, I think in the way that, how do I put this? In the way that spiritual blessings and benefits were conceived in ancient India, one way of looking at it was through this kind of lens that some things are better than others, right? So you have a kind of a ranking of different things. And so here you can see this kind of ranking of one thing after another. So what does the ranking mean? Well, so merit essentially means that which creates happiness, right? Or it means that which alleviates suffering, right? So we can think about it in those terms. If you give a certain amount, then you create happiness for the person that you give to. You also create happiness for yourself because of your good karma in doing that. Right? So that's that degree of karma which you've done from that. If you give something greater, then you get more. If you take precepts, the Buddha is saying, then that's even more so. And if you create do the metta meditation, that's even more so. And if you develop insight into impermanence, then that's even more so. So think about it in terms of like the eradication of suffering. So if you develop deep insight, then you eradicate a vast quantity of suffering, next to which the blessings of generosity are relatively small. Having said which, like when the Buddha is saying these kinds of things, he's not meaning to say, don't worry about being generous, just go and meditate, right? Because generosity is the foundation for meditation. Ethics is the foundation for meditation. All of these things build on each other. So he's just trying to get us to focus on those higher things. Okay. Letty asks, thank you so much, Bhante. So does that mean all beings are the same, a bit like oneness, but the difference between eternalism and Buddhism is the one and the same is always changing, not a permanent self? So I'm not exactly sure what you're trying to say here, but the idea is that the one and the same expression means that it is eternal. That's an eternal change of self, and that's what the idea that the Buddha is rejecting here. Then Sumana asks, I assume naked ascetics were mostly male. Were there female naked ascetics? I'm glad that you're thinking about the important things here, Sumana. Were there female naked ascetics in the time of the Buddha? Was it documented in the Pali canon for female and the full spectrum naked ascetics? So in the Jain tradition, they say that women should not be going naked as naked ascetics. So the women ascetic, they had a lot of nuns. Even according to their own records, there were far more nuns at every period of history than there were monks. But they would wear one cloth rather than going fully naked. Just to mention that the Jains had two sects. The Digambara is the sky-clad sect, so they were naked, or the men were naked. The ascetics, not everyone, just the ascetics, and then the Svetambara, where they would wear the one white cloth. So all of the women ascetics would wear white cloth. As far as the Brahmanical ascetics, I can't recall any specific mentions of female Brahmanical ascetics who were going naked. I wouldn't rule it out though, but I don't think so. Okay. So Chandima asks, how's it going, Chandima? I hope you're doing well. You're in England, right?
Yes, Bante.
How's the UK going?
Oh, I don't know. I think I'm all right. That's all I know.
So that's all that matters. Okay, excellent, excellent. That's great. Anyway, good. Well, that's something anyway. Fine. Okay, so why did I use the word cause rather than requirement in explaining dependent origination? So the reason for that, that's really kind of a lot of contemplation and thought goes into some of these things. So the cause, actually to use the word cause is good because it's nice and easy and straightforward. You can say ignorance causes choices or choices cause consciousness and so on. The problem is that it then orientates the sentence in a forward direction. This thing goes to that thing. This thing goes to that thing, right? Whereas the actual phrasing of it sort of leans back. Actually, the word pacaya means goes back to, right? So it's like the second thing goes back to the first thing, right? The third thing goes back to the second thing and so on. So that's the actual phrasing. So it's not necessarily a fundamental difference because you find all different kinds of phrasing, right? The causality is expressed in all different kinds of ways. But in that particular phrase, that tended to be the emphasis. So when I was playing around with the different kinds of ways of expressing that, then that was what I came up with to try to keep that sense that it's kind of leaning back to the former one rather than the forward one pushing forward to the later one. Yeah? In that particular phrasing, of course, other places it's different. Say ignorance is a requirement for choices or a cause. So when you say ignorance is a requirement for choices rather than a cause, I understood it as there may be other conditions necessary than ignorance for sankhara to arise. Yes, that's true. So that's actually another good point. So in Buddhist causality generally, it is held that there are multiple causes and multiple effects. There's not like one cause and one effect. So the teaching is given in terms of one cause and one effect, but in fact, it's always ramified. There are always other things involved. And the Buddha is identifying the key items rather than saying this is the only thing. All right. If ignorance is there, sankhara is inevitable. Is that correct? If ignorance is there, sankhara is inevitable. Probably. But ignorance, you know, the Buddha's talking about sentient beings, right? So ignorance itself has a cause. And ignorance doesn't exist by itself. It exists as a property of a sentient being who has all of the other things that a being has. So these things are there as well. All right. okay, so Kaz asks, so is the Buddha showing the concept of anatta by stating dependent origination? That's why he says not so for Kasapa's question. Yeah, there's a very close relationship between dependent origination and the teaching of not self. So you can see that that the Buddha, by rejecting all those four options, right, he's doing one of his favorite things, which is just to say no to everything. Okay, and so the Buddha will really like saying no to everything. And as I think I mentioned in an earlier talk, this is a characteristic of Yajnavalkya. So in the Brahmanical tradition, there are basically two modes of philosophical dialogue, the mode of affirmation and the mode of negation. And typically, Brahmanical texts often work by the mode of affirmation. This is this. You are that. You are this. Everything is honey. Everything is good. Everything is this. It's always everything's positive, right? But Yajnavalkya said neti, neti, not that, not that. And so he worked by saying, let's slough off all those things that we don't need. And of course, at the end, he still held on to the consciousness as being the highest self, but everything else he let go of. And that, as I mentioned before, is the tradition that the Buddha studied in under his former Brahman teachers. So he was educated in that method of neti, neti, not that, not that. Yeah. That's really kind of interesting when you think of it that way, that, you know, you can think like a very bright student under that system. Like neti, neti, oh, we get rid of this, we get rid of this, we get rid of this, but then we hold on to this. Well, why? Right? Why are we holding on to this? What would happen if we let go of that as well? Yeah. So, so you can see that the teaching of dependent origination rejects the two, these are two self doctrines, right? Everything, the eternalist doctrine is one doctrine of self. The annihilationist doctrine is another kind of doctrine of self. And the Buddha is rejecting both of those doctrines. Okay, so this is, do we have any more questions? Any from the room on this one? Scott wants to know, is there anywhere I can find the story at the start with the fortune teller? Sure you can. I'm giving a full service here. So for those, if you want to read Jatakas, you can find Jatakas on Sutta Central. However, the best source for the Jatakas is actually Venerable Ananda Jyoti's site, ancientbuddhisttexts.net. I'm just going to put the link in here. And he's sort of doing a kind of a long-term project with the Jatakas and doing various kinds of things and so on. So his texts are better. That's the general link for the Jataka page. And I'm just going to give the specific story. Okay. I really do think it is a funny story. I just love the king's deadpan at the end. Oh, well, I guess it works out. Anyway, there's Jataka 126. So that's giving you that story there. Okay. Jose.
At the beginning of the sutta, what's the reason that the Buddha gave to say that it wasn't the proper time to teach?
Because he was going for alms round. Oh. Yeah, so he's just got his bowl, he's going to the village, he's hungry. Mm. Right? It's probably like noon's coming, he's got to get back. That's the kind of a standard thing. Usually the Buddha would, there's a few instances where that would happen. And okay. So I was not sure if I should go and do another sutta for today, but it looks like we're probably running a bit late, so I think we're probably full up. What do you reckon? I think probably full up. Okay, I won't try to overstuff you all with more things. Thanks, everybody, for attending today, and thanks for persisting through this course. Hopefully it is helpful for you. I just actually, before we go, I wanted to mention one thing, which is that I'm going to be moving house. So time to tell people. And so we've been working on this for some time recently, and it seems like everything's sort of fallen into place. So just let everyone know. Number one thing that you all have to know is nothing's going to change, okay? Talks are going to be, I'm still staying in Parramatta. Everything is going to be the same. What it was before will be happening afterwards. Nothing will ever change, okay? And talks will stay the same, and Pindabhata will stay the same, and I'll still be in the Parramatta region, okay? So that's all. So this came about because some months ago, about 6 months ago or something, my mother was, so she's sorting out her affairs, and she said that she asked, is there anything that I wanted? I said, well, it would be nice if we didn't have to pay $500 a week in rent. So mum has some apartments in Perth, so she's selling an apartment in Perth, and she's buying one here in Parramatta that I can stay in. Yay! thanks to my mum. Thanks to Deepika for sort of negotiating with the estate agent. Thanks to Radha for driving us around to look at all the different places. And thanks to Maya for doing the legal work.
So which penthouse
then
is it?
Sorry? I'll show you when we're ready. You can all come round and we can have a cup of tea. So Venerable Prasanna is posted an event. Rain Bodhi Sydney is having an event at Green Square Library, Sunday 14th of September at 1:30 p.m. with Venerable Prasanna. Yay! Mm-hmm. Excellent. Good on you. Meta Convention is coming up on 8th and 9th of November. It's 2 months away. Okay. 8th and 9th of November, so put it in your calendar, and the Meta Convention, so check the website of the Meta Center. They'll have all the details on that. There's various events happening around the time, so please do check that out. And lots of different teachers and monastics and so on visiting, and lots of things happening around that time.
Speaking of that matter, that's happening the next day, which is the 10th that we
talked about. Oh, right.
I've confirmed the number of monastics. Right. There's going to be 12.
There'll be 12 monastics. And what, are we going to Harris Park?
That's what you suggested.
Yeah, please. Yeah, let's do that. So on, and what day is that again?
Monday the 10th.
Monday the 10th, we're going to have 12 monastics in Harris Park. Oh, wow. Awesome. That'll be the that'll be the biggest number that we've ever had there. Yeah. This is one of the main reasons why I want to stay in this area, because the Pindabhata in Harris Park has been amazing. Mm-hmm. And I've been going there for years now, and the support has been fantastic. And yeah. They'll be thrilled to see a dozen monastics walking down. Also, by the way, just let people know, while we're on the topic of talking about Pindabhata, I'm doing a newish kind of practice where on the Sunday I'm going to different places for Pindabhata, so I'm not in Harris Park. This first Sunday I'll be in Parramatta. So I'm actually going to the Holy Basil, and a couple of other restaurants have invited me to Pindabhata there. So if you're around in Parramatta, see you then. That's on Sunday.
This Sunday is
okay. Hopefully. Yeah. Oh, right. Lots of people eating out. Yeah. So that's on the Sunday. And any other news we need to let people know? Everything good. Thanks, everybody. Our Wednesday night talks at Crow's Nest. So please come along. Crow's Nest Community Centre, 7 o'clock on a Wednesday night. Okay. Thanks, everybody. See you again.